From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict, commenced at a time of our choosing. For their own safety, all foreign nationals, including journalists and inspectors, should leave Iraq immediately.
President Bush brings the world to the edge of war. We'll hear from former UN Assistant Secretary General Dennis Halliday.
The only hope we have is the people of the United States of America. The rest of us overseas have marched and talked and worked, and it makes no difference to a man like Bush. Only his own political career, his re-election in 2004, really count. I think he's got to get a signal, a very clear signal from millions upon millions of Americans that this behavior, this action is totally unacceptable across this great country. And he's got to get that message in 48 hours, let's say, if not sooner.
Then we go to Indiana, where a decorated Gulf War veteran, Lewis Jones Jr., was just executed. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is the War and Peace Report. President Bush last night vowed to attack Iraq if President Saddam Hussein and his sons do not flee the country within 48 hours. President Bush addressed the nation on primetime television. The Iraqi government immediately rejected the ultimatum. Bush also told Iraqi soldiers not to fight for a dying regime and not to destroy Iraq's oil wells. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan ordered the evacuation of the weapons inspectors and humanitarian staff from the country. The first wave of UN workers has already landed in Cyprus. Kofi Annan also suspended the Oil for Food program. Bush's speech came just hours after the U.S. and Britain admitted they'd failed to win U.N. Security Council backing for war. They pulled the second U.N. resolution without taking a vote. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan challenged the legitimacy of unilateral military action, but refrained from branding it illegal. In Britain, three ministers have already resigned. The leader of the British House of Commons, Robin Cook, resigned just after the U.S. and Britain pulled the U.N. resolution. His resignation speech late last night was met with an unprecedented round of applause and a standing ovation by some members of Parliament. Today, Home Office Minister John Denham and Health Minister Lord Hunt of King's Heath also resigned. But International Development Secretary Clare Short announced she would stay in her cabinet post despite earlier threats to resign. Russian President Vladimir Putin called for a peaceful resolution, said a U.S. attack would have the, quote, gravest consequences. Meanwhile, the Russian parliament delayed ratification of a major nuclear disarmament treaty with the U.S. A parliamentary spokesman said the decision was made after Bush's declaration and, quote, in the conditions of the massive U.S. pressure on the international community. French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin denounced the United States for pulling the resolution from the UN. He said a wide majority of the 15 members of the Security Council oppose the U.S. He said the U.S., Britain, and Spain are resorting to force, quote, despite the clearly expressed will of the international community. German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder said today there is no justification for war that will, quote, bring certain death to thousands of innocent men, women, and children. Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao opposed Bush's ultimatum to Saddam Hussein and held out hope of a diplomatic solution. This news just in from Yemen. An American, a Canadian, and a Yemeni were shot dead in an attack by a Yemeni gunman who then killed himself at an oil field east of Sana'a. The U.S. government raised its terrorist threat level to orange or high risk last night as President Bush was delivering his speech on Iraq. Top federal officials ask states to deploy the National Guard or state police to protect sensitive sites across the nation from possible attack. A Vatican spokesperson told Vatican Radio, quote, "War is a crime against peace which cries for vengeance before God." He said war is deeply unjust and immoral and said God condemns war because civilians suffer the most. Archbishop Renato Rafael Martino is the Vatican's former permanent representative to the United Nations. He strongly denounced the Bush administration, quote, "Do not reply with a stone to the child who asks for bread." He said, quote, "They are preparing to reply with thousands of bombs to a people that has been asking for bread for the last 12 years. The Turkish government and military leaders have reached agreement on allowing U.S. troops to use Turkey as a northern front in an attack on Iraq. The cabinet will discuss the measure today, and Parliament could take up the issue tomorrow. The Parliament has voted against the deployment of U.S. troops in Turkey several days ago. Meanwhile, protesters are engaging in daily nonviolent direct actions around the country this week. Over 50 people were arrested in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Dozens more were arrested at the United Nations in New York City and in San Francisco. We'll have more on that story in our second hour.
America, indeed the world, is under attack from a sinister force led by a boy. The world's most powerful boy, Owlboy.
Dear Daddy. Dear Daddy.
Owlboy, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. It's the boy who loves to dish out pain.
Owlboy,
sacrifice me and you. Once 100 more be two. For the power, for the few.
The entire world, is
Power Boy. It's not your planet to destroy.
The entire world is the battlefield.
Drunk with the power, he's more scary by the hour. While the planet gets devoured, Power Boy.
Power Boy, Patriotica, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush last night vowed to attack Iraq if President Saddam Hussein and his sons do not flee the country within 48 hours. President Bush addressed the nation on primetime television.
The United States and other nations did nothing to deserve or invite this threat, but we will do everything to defeat it. Instead of drifting along toward tragedy, we will set a course toward safety. Before the day of horror can come, before it is too late to act, this danger will be removed. The United States of America has the sovereign authority to use force in assuring its own national security. That duty falls to me as Commander-in-Chief by the oath I have sworn, by the oath I will keep. Recognizing the threat to our country, the United States Congress voted overwhelmingly last year to support the use of force against Iraq. America tried to work with the United Nations to address this threat because we wanted to resolve the issue peacefully. We believe in the mission of the United Nations. One reason the UN was founded after the Second World War was to confront aggressive dictators actively and early, before they can attack the innocent and destroy the peace. In the case of Iraq, the Security Council did act in the early 1990s. Under resolutions 678 and 687, both still in effect, the United States and our allies are authorized to use force in ridding Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. This is not a question of authority. It is a question of will.
President George Bush addressing the nation last night. In our studios last night, just after Bush gave his address, we were joined by Dennis Halliday. Dennis Halliday is the former assistant UN Secretary General. He was with the United Nations for more than 30 years. then became head of the oil for food program in Iraq, then quit, calling the sanctions regime genocidal. After we speak with Dennis Halliday, we will talk to a veteran of the Persian Gulf War about how he feels now, and particularly his contention that U.S. troops are not prepared for a biochemical attack. We turn now to Dennis Halliday and his response.
Well, he started off by saying that 12 years of diplomacy have failed. He forgot to mention that 12 years of sanctions have not only failed, but have killed probably over 1 million Iraqis, particularly young children. Sanctions that have been sustained by the United States and Britain in particular, punishing the Iraqi people collectively in breach of international law for crimes or for weapons that their government holds, nothing to do with them as civilians of the country.
Did anything he said surprise you?
He said we were a country of peace, and that is a strange statement coming out of his very aggressive stand and military ambitions to go to war against Iraq. He didn't give us the truth. He told us about weapons of mass destruction. He forgot to mention oil and control of oil. He forgot to mention his colonial ambitions and ambitions for American empire in the Middle East. He forgot to tell us about the need to have a military presence, apparently, in the Middle East when Iraq is invaded and occupied. He forgot to inform us of his blind support of Israel and Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. He left out a few details.
What about George Bush saying last week that no matter what, he would call for a vote at the UN Security Council on a second resolution, and now backing off, seeing that he's not going to get that, and saying they have withdrawn the resolution?
Yes, very strange behavior. One can only assume that there's an element of inexperience in the regime in Washington at the moment vis-a-vis the United Nations. They've brought in some strange people. General Powell himself obviously is not experienced as a diplomat, nor with the United Nations. I think he's just been badly advised, and clearly he's fallen on his face.
What does this mean right now, this Operation Shock and Awe, for the people of Iraq, whom you have worked with in Iraq and have visited since?
I think it means that we'll see photographs, we'll see shots of families being destroyed, of children being blown apart, of heads being literally taken off small bodies. We'll see families, homes, the streets littered with rubble and human remains. I mean, this is going to be the most cruel, I think, devastating military attack on the towns and cities of this country, where the majority of Iraqis live, where they're planning to stay because they have nowhere else to go. They don't have basements. They don't have ways of hiding themselves from the horror of United States military endeavors. These high-flying heroes at 30,000 feet who will drop ordnance on Iraqi children, Iraqi people, without regard to life. It's a form of terrorism, I think, of the very worst kind, endorsed by a president who doesn't seem to be more high-minded or more idealistic or more suitable for leadership than perhaps bin Laden or perhaps Saddam Hussein himself.
What about what Blair is facing for the support of Bush? The latest news, Robin Cook, the cabinet member who has just resigned.
Well, Mr. Blair has dug himself a very deep hole. It's rather hard to understand. He's a man of some intelligence, clearly. But a bit like Mr. Bush, he's somewhat messianic, born again, simplistic, everything's black or white or good or evil. But he certainly alienated himself from within the Labour Party, from his own members, from his own cabinet. One wonders how long he will survive. I would guess he'd be overthrown like Thatcher was by the Conservatives and replaced by somebody more representative of Britain and British requirements.
In Bush's speech, he encouraged all foreign nationals, including journalists and inspectors, to leave Iraq immediately. It made me think about Rachel Corrie, the 23-year-old American woman who was killed by Israeli troops on Sunday in Gaza as she was trying to stop another housing demolition. The Israeli tank drove over her and then reversed and drove back over her. She was an American observer with the International Solidarity Movement. And the threat that these observers, whether Rachel Corrie in Gaza, pose, or journalists, inspectors in Iraq.
I think that the presence of foreigners is seen by the Bush regime to be dangerous. A woman like Rachel Corrie, with her courage, is just extraordinary for all of us, I think, to witness and hopefully to endorse and try to follow. It's very threatening to Mr. Bush and the people around him in Washington. And I think that's true of foreigners in Iraq, whether they're United Nations or they're inspectors. They simply get in the way, and we know Mr. Bush doesn't tolerate that sort of nonsense.
And finally, on the issue of where the media is going to go right now, this new term, the embedded journalist, not to be confused with the journalist embed with the military, but embedded journalists, with journalists now having to leave Iraq, but going in with the military. FAIR has come out with a new study, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. In Iraq crisis, networks are megaphones for official views. Study finds TV marginalizing dissenting voices. It says network newscasts dominated by current and former U.S. officials largely exclude Americans who are skeptical of or opposed to an invasion of Iraq. Looking at 2 weeks of coverage from January 30th to February 12th, FAIR examined close to 400 on-camera sources who appeared in nightly news stories about Iraq on ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, NBC Nightly News, and PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. The study began 1 week before and ended 1 week after Secretary of State Colin Powell's February 5th presentation to the UN, a time that saw particularly intense debate about the idea of a war against Iraq on the national and international level. More than two-thirds of the guests featured were from the United States. Of the U.S. guests, three-quarters were either current or former government or military officials. Only one of the official U.S. sources, Senator Edward Kennedy, expressed skepticism or opposition to the war. Even this was couched in vague terms. Similarly, when both U.S. and non-U.S. guests were included, more than three-quarters were either current or retired officials. Such a predominance of official sources virtually assures that independent and grassroots perspectives will be underrepresented. Your comment on the role that the media plays in this country, and you travel a lot and you come from Ireland and spend time in many other places, in this drive for war?
Well, I think it's very sad to know that the American people do not get the news as news. They get it as entertainment. They do not get to see both sides of a situation. They're not allowed to, apparently, to understand what happens when you go to war. They're not aware of the consequences. This is very, I think, dangerous and very sad, and it means that we have an ill-informed populace in this country who are seeing war being turned into a game, made attractive, exciting, romantic almost. It's bizarre to see this happening. And I myself always turn to the BBC in New York to try to get another perspective on what's happening. And the BBC could do some work also. We saw the New York Times coming out with some excellent pieces recently, op-ed and editorial pieces. But, you know, by and large, the average American doesn't see that quality of coverage, whether it's BBC or New York Times. They rely on very basic information sources, and they are being misled, I think, tragically.
It's quite something. The UN clearly was not going, the UN Security Council, to support George Bush in his push for war. What was your take on a story that hardly got any coverage in this country? And that was the UN spying story, the U.S. spying story. A National Security Agency document came out, more top secret than the CIA, the NSA, saying that they would conduct a surge on the UN Security Council diplomats, specifically the African countries like Guinea, Cameroon, Angola, Pakistan, Bulgaria, and eavesdrop on, bug their home and office phones, their faxes, their emails. And this was also sent to British intelligence to help with this spying. You're a veteran of the UN of more than 30 years. Did this surprise you? And also the fact that in this country, it got almost no play.
No, this did not surprise me. In fact, it reminds me of 1944 and 1945 in San Francisco, when the United States bugged the delegations who were negotiating the charter. It's exactly the same story, just a few years on. And it's an indication, I think, of the contempt that the United States has for the United Nations and the sovereignty of the Security Council and the sovereignty of member states who make up the United Nations.
And what is your comment now? As the U.S., I still won't say war is inevitable, but as Bush says, that he gives Saddam Hussein 48 hours to flee Iraq. Your thought on where this will lead and what people can do? Do you think this is a time where people just give up?
No. I like you, I'm struggling to find some optimistic sense somewhere deep in my soul. And I think the only key, the only hope we have is the people of the United States of America. The rest of us overseas have marched and talked and worked, and it makes no difference to a man like Bush. Only his own political career, his re-election in 2004, really count. I think he's got to get a signal, a very clear signal from millions upon millions of Americans that this behavior, this action is totally unacceptable across this great country. And he's got to get that message in 48 hours, let's say, if not sooner. Because what he's established for Baghdad is a schedule which is unworkable and unreal, which seems to indicate that war is certainly on his mind. But we can be hopeful, but I think only hopeful if the American people somehow rise up and take over their own country and make democracy work.
That was Dennis Halliday, Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, responding to George Bush's ultimatum for war. When we come back, we'll talk to a Gulf War veteran. Back in a minute.
Hey, we shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Darling, in my heart, yeah, I do believe we shall. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand someday. Darling, here in my heart, yeah, I do believe.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Casualties. U.S. casualties, Iraqi casualties. What will be the number? After the Persian Gulf War, when General Powell was asked about Iraqis dead, he said, "We don't count the enemy dead." And what about the United States? Ask many veterans of the Persian Gulf, and they say casualties can't be measured by the 148 who died or the 500 wounded in battle. In the 12 years since, nearly 164,000 Gulf vets, about 28% of those who served, have been certified by government doctors for service-related medical claims, more than twice the rate of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. The Veterans Administration doesn't track how many of those are suffering from Gulf War syndrome, but the government's own studies consistently show that up to 30% of Gulf vets are sufferers. Now, as some 300,000 troops await orders to strike Iraq again, a cadre of Gulf veterans worry that the same epidemic of unexplained illnesses threatens a new generation of soldiers and perhaps their children. Steve Robinson is with us right now. He's executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center in Washington, D.C., and he himself is a Persian Gulf vet. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. You wrote a letter to President Bush. Can you tell us what you said?
I did, along with several other high-ranking, knowledgeable people who have both fought in wars and understand the cost of war. We wrote a letter to the president basically saying that there were significant deficiencies that were not being reported to the public and the media, and especially to the troops who were getting ready to deploy and who have deployed. These deficiencies consisted of army audits and government accounting reports that talked about whether or not we were prepared to fight a chemical and biological battle. Specifically, the most startling things out of the reports were that 62% of the gas masks and 90% of the chemical detectors our troops would currently use were reported to be defective just a year ago. We're not sure how much they have changed within 1 year, and we haven't had the government respond to the questions that we've asked about what have they fixed. But additionally, there were public laws that were designed to protect soldiers that were written and ratified in 1998 that said, because we don't want to have another mystery illness and because we don't want to have another 12 years of delays, denials, and obfuscation from the government, we're going to take baseline samples of soldiers before they go by drawing their blood and screening them medically to ensure they're fit before they depart. And then we're going to draw their blood and screen them medically when they return. We have since found out that the Department of Defense did not, in accordance with the public law, draw the blood from the soldiers. So potentially we may have a situation where there is no baseline data and they will be able to hold up their hands and say, sorry, we didn't draw the blood, therefore we can't do the measurements. Now, why is this important? It's important because just 3 weeks ago, the Institute of Medicine released a report that talked about pesticides and solvents used in the first Gulf War. And although they concluded that these pesticides and solvents by themselves or in combinations caused health effects, and there's well-documented evidence to show it in the civilian world, they couldn't draw the link that Gulf War veterans were ill because of pesticides and solvents exposure because there was no baseline data drawn and there was no blood sampling taken from soldiers when they returned. You may know that we can look at blood down to the molecular level. We can see changes in cells, but if we don't get the data first and then draw it when the soldiers return, then we're not able to answer the riddle. And so we wrote a letter to the president, basically putting on the record the fact that we knew this wasn't being done, and that spurred other letters to be written by senators and congressmen. Senator Kerry called for a government accounting investigation. Senator Feinstein and Feingold wrote letters to Secretary Rumsfeld, and Congressman Christopher Shays is going to hold hearings that will happen on the 25th of this month, in which my organization will testify about the deficiencies and about the fact that the public law is being ignored. Unfortunately, all of this seems too little too late, as it appears that we are 48 hours away from war.
We're talking to Steve Robinson, Gulf War veteran, executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, looking at the latest Reuters piece on the prospect of another Gulf War, bringing with it renewed concerns about exposure to nerve gas on the battlefield, as well as fears of a potential chemical attack by terrorists. Let's talk about the sources of the chemical exposure. While President Bush talks about terrorist attack and talks about Saddam Hussein releasing chemical weapons, what about what happened at Kamacia? Can you explain that, Steve?
Sure. Before we talk about Kamacia, let's talk about something that's not reported yet. There were over 982 sorties that were flown on 900-some-odd targets in the first Gulf War, where we bombed either known or suspected chemical warfare agent facilities. And that was the whole purpose of degrading Saddam's capability before we begin to fight the first Gulf War. Actually, that's an incorrect term. It's the Gulf War, because we don't know if this next one's going to actually happen yet. So over 982 sites that were known or suspected chemical warfare agent storage facilities or biological storage facilities. That product went up into the atmosphere somewhere and went in a certain direction that's not yet known. And it hasn't really been studied, although the CIA came out with a report that said they've conclusively studied and made sure that nothing would have went over the troops. We really don't know. So In the first Gulf War, again, I say it again, that's a bad habit. In the Gulf War, veterans who fought it conducted many operations, and one of them was an operation at a place called Camisea. Now, the military did not admit, after veterans returned, that there were any chemical or biological weapons on the battlefield. In fact, they said the three no's, and the three no's were this. No, there were no chemical or biological weapons on the battlefield. Therefore, no one could be sick, and therefore you, who are making this claim, are ill because of stress. And for 7 years after the Gulf War, the department continued to deny that there were even chemical or biological weapons present on the battlefield. Then in 1996, my organization obtained a document through the Freedom of Information Act from UNSCOM, which stated that engineers in UNMOVIC, now UNMOVIC, at that time UNSCOM had identified a place where engineers from the 82nd Airborne had conducted a demolition operation, and the place was known as Camisea. And
Steve Robinson, are you there? Looks like we just lost Steve Robinson. Steve Robinson is executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, was a veteran of the Persian Gulf War. I should say, as we get him back on the line, that afterwards we're going to find out about the execution of Lewis Jones. He was executed just as we went to broadcast. He is a Gulf War veteran who said he was exposed to the chemicals of the Camisea, blowing up of the Camisea chemical depot in the Persian Gulf, and that explained what was going on with him. But we have Steve Robinson back on the line. Go ahead, Steve.
Yep, not sure what happened there. At any rate, UNSCOM inspected the site, and they found that there were 37 large ammunition bunkers, and that one of the bunkers, Bunker 73, contained 2,000 chemical warfare agent-filled rockets. And it was obvious that these rockets were part of the demolition operation. So then the Department of Defense admitted, okay, there were chemical and biological weapons on the battlefield, and you did explode them at a place called Camisea, but no one died after you exploded them, so the potential that anybody could have long-term health effects is zero. And they said that because no one had first noticeable effects, that soldiers couldn't possibly be ill. And then they began to try to estimate how many people would have been exposed to these low levels of sarin. At first, they said, well, maybe 100 people were exposed. And they came back a few months later and said maybe 1,000 people were exposed. And right now, as it currently stands, they've estimated that over 140,000 people potentially were exposed to low levels of the nerve agent sarin. Now, that modeling process that they used to make that determination is currently under investigation by the Government Accounting Office. But what's most interesting is that immediately the department said, okay, 140,000 people were exposed, but no one could possibly be ill because the levels of sarin were so low. And what I would say to that now is studies have recently come out. In fact, a study just got released today, but the ones I'm going to refer to recently came out that said low-level exposure to sarin can cause long-term health effects. Because just like there was a time when I was a child, when I looked up at the moon, we really hadn't dominated spaceflight, and going to the moon and landing on it or building the space station was the stuff of comic books. When Gulf War veterans returned from the war and they began to complain of illnesses as a result of exposure, and the department denied them, we knew that science was going to catch up one day, and that credible science and credible reporting would eclipse the denials, and that has in fact come true. The scientific studies are stacking up one on top of one another about how exposure to low-level chemical warfare agent or organophosphates or pesticides or the myriad of things that veterans had been exposed to in the first Gulf War were in fact causal factors in why they were ill. So Camisea was the watershed event, in which the department was forced to admit that chemical warfare agents were on the battlefield. And it's really the reason why we say we're going back to war with Iraq now. But if you look back at history, you'll see that they denied it from 1990 until 1996. And then after they had been shown to have obfuscated the truth, they then began on a campaign to say that stress was the reason why veterans were ill. Now all of those theories have been shot down by credible science. And as we approach the next Gulf War, we're concerned that the soldiers who may be fighting this potential chemical and biological war with Iraq are faced with the exact same mistakes as 1991. And that's why the Government Accounting Office has been asked to conduct an investigation. That's why Christopher Shays will hold a congressional hearing. And that's why these senators are now stepping up to the plate at the last, you know, the last hour, the 59th minute, the 59th second, to say we're concerned, and they're putting their views on the record.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Steve Robinson, Executive Director of the National Gulf War Resource Center. And you are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to what happened this morning. At just about 7 a.m., decorated Gulf War veteran Lewis Jones Jr. executed in Terre Haute, Indiana. President Bush denied his request for clemency last night. The U.S. Supreme Court also refused to block the execution yesterday. Jones was convicted of kidnapping, rape, and the murder of a fellow Army officer in Texas in 95. In 2000, he received a letter from the Pentagon telling him that he had been exposed to nerve agents in the Gulf War. The chemicals were released when the Army demolished a munitions plant in Qamishia, Iraq, in March 91. The Pentagon has since said the chemicals were the nerve agents sarin and cyclosarin. The evidence of Jones' exposure to nerve agents was not available at his trial in 95, though the defense did argue that he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. In a letter to President Bush, he admitted that he wantonly took a precious life. He wrote of his victim, quote, "I think of the Marine she was engaged to. I think of the children she could have had. Her son could have discovered a cure for a disease of our time." Mr. Jones, who wrote that he'd become a Christian, asked for clemency so that he could minister to other prisoners for the rest of his life. This morning, about a dozen death penalty opponents held a candlelight vigil just a quarter mile from the prison. A sign leaning against a fence in front of the group said, "The tragic irony. As we rush recklessly to war with Iraq, we're killing a veteran of the first Gulf War." Dick Burr is on the line with us, the attorney for Lewis Jones and a longtime federal death penalty expert. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, I know this is a very sad time for you. Within the last hour, Lewis Jones, your client, executed. Can you talk about, we'll make the connection between what we just heard, Steve Robinson talking about Qamishia, and the circumstances of Lewis Jones' case?
Sure. It's really chilling to listen to Steve's quite impressive historical account, because Lewis Jones' crime occurred in early 1995. His trial occurred in late 1995. And there was evidence of brain damage to a part of a deep structure within the brain called basal ganglia that, ironically, the government expert discovered on an MRI. None of the experts for the defense or the government made anything of that at the trial. They just said it's sort of an anomaly in his brain. There was some evidence put on by the defense that Lou Jones was near some nerve gas canisters at some point. The government put on somebody from the Army in response to say, absolutely not, no way, he could not have been exposed to nerve gas. This is in 1995. In 2000, 5 years after Lou Jones had been on death row, the government sent Lou Jones two letters saying that he had been exposed to nerve gas at Qamishia. Of course, they never reached Lou Jones. They were returned addressee unknown. And we only found them after paying an organization several thousand dollars to search through military records and find those documents. And that's the backdrop for Lou Jones. There's no doubt now that the basal ganglia damage was caused by the sarin. The leading expert for the government, Dr. Robert Haley, who's been the leading researcher on neurological damage as a result of low-level sarin exposure, was the expert in Lou Jones' case. Dr. Haley works in a commission set up by the Veterans Administration to issue authoritative scientific pronouncements about the knowledge we have about Gulf War Syndrome. All of this made no difference to the president. It's really hard to explain how any human being with a mind and a soul could not be responsive to this. Numerous Republicans in the Congress, all of whom are ardent death penalty supporters, came to support Lewis Jones because they intuitively recognized the gross injustice of what had happened.
Well, Dick Burr, I want to thank you for joining us today at this very difficult hour, and I want to have you back on to talk about how you keep going from one case to another with Texas's death row, the busiest in the country. Dick Burr, lawyer for Lewis Jones, who was executed just as we were going to broadcast this morning. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
To the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of vengeance in a thousand different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all?
Phil Oakes, I won't be marching anymore. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Professor Michael Clare, Five College Professor and Director of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, talking about American militarism and oil.
Why is oil so important to American strategy? Let me very quickly make the argument. I don't have time to, obviously, to do that in great detail. But essentially, our economy, our way of life, depends on access to abundant and cheap oil. New York City is unusual. It's the only place pretty much in this country where you can get by without an automobile. And I grew up in New York City. I love the city and love the subways and buses. We're very fortunate. Most Americans depend on automobiles to get from one place to another, and our society is hardwired now with interstates and suburbs to rely more and more on automobiles to get around. So suburbs, the construction industry, malls, the automobile industry, steel, pharmaceuticals, petroleum, you know, a good chunk of the American economy runs on oil. And when the price of oil rises, as it does periodically, each time that's happened since World War II, there's been a recession. And we're in that situation now. Our economy is very much sensitive to the availability of oil. I think you're aware of that. I think less obvious is the fact that the American military is equally dependent on oil. We pride ourselves in this country, or some of us do anyway, about how powerful our military is and how it's the best and could do all these wonderful things. You know, you can fly places from this country, drop bombs, and then return to this country. It's an amazing the capacity of the military. But this is a military that entirely depends on oil. It wouldn't function for 30 seconds without oil. Its tanks, its planes, its ships, all of them rely on oil. We're very capital intensive, machine intensive, and oil intensive military. And that's been America's forte, is the ability to overpower enemies with machines. That's been the essence of our military policy since World War II. And we must have oil to do that. We cannot fight our wars without it. At least we could go back to sailing ships and send our Marines over that way. But that's what we would be reduced to. So oil is essential. And one third point I want to make is there's something ironic about this, whether you believe in the Almighty or Mother Nature or random chance or whatever you believe in, how the Earth was formed. There's an irony in all of this. Mother Nature provided this country with a very large supply of oil, one of the largest in the world. It was the first to be discovered in 1859 in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and the first to be developed on a very large scale. And it was the development of oil that created the great corporations, the modern American multinational corporations, Standard Oil of New York, Standard Oil of New Jersey, the Rockefellers, Standard Oil, now ExxonMobil and the other big oil corporations, and our way of life, the suburban way of life that developed Long Island, New Jersey, all of that was product of the fact that this country was well endowed with oil. But we were the first to develop our oil, the first to use it up. And we're using it up at a very rapid rate, and we have been for quite some time. Also, Mother Nature, in her wisdom, or maybe she's laughing at us, put the rest of the world's oil in the Middle East, with a little bit in Russia and the Caspian Sea, a little bit in Colombia and Venezuela, some in the west coast of Africa, but two-thirds or more is in the Middle East. Whether this was some kind of trick on us or a statement or whatever, we have become dependent on a product which is only found in the Middle East, and we can't do without it. This is the dilemma. This dilemma first became apparent to American leaders in World War II, and it was Franklin Roosevelt's administration that first saw all of these three come together. The U.S. won World War II with its oil. Of course, you know that the atom bomb sort of set the stage, ended the final few days of the war, but Japan was already defeated. Germany was defeated by that point, and it was not our superior weapons. Germany had better weapons than we did, and it was not our industrial or strategic military superiority. Germany was better in all those things. We had oil, they didn't. So we could put pump oil into our planes and tanks in the final battles. Germany couldn't, and we won the war. Japan ran out of oil because submarines destroyed all their tankers. They didn't have any. They ran out of oil. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating this, but certainly for Franklin Roosevelt, this was at the center of their thinking. He died before the bomb was dropped. For him, oil was what made the U.S. win the war. And he knew we were running out, that the U.S. was running out of oil, and that we were going to need it for our military and economic superiority. And to make a long story short, his solution was to take over Saudi Arabia. Now, originally his plan was to do this by creating a state-owned, American government-owned corporation, the Strategic Reserves Corporation, Petroleum Reserves Corporation, copied on British Petroleum, which was a state-owned company. Now BP is now privatized, but it was a British government. It was a government corporation because the British government wanted control of oil for national security purposes. FDR wanted to set up an American corporation to own Saudi Arabian oil and to protect it with American troops as a national security measure. Congress didn't go along with that, so he had to agree to form a partnership between the government as the protector and the corporations pumping the oil, because then they sort of had to get the people, you know, the rulers of Saudi Arabia to go along with this plan. So in 1945, FDR met with King Abdulaziz ibn Saud on the carrier, the USS Quincy, in the Suez Canal, the leader of the free world, meeting with a potentate who brought his slaves on board American ships. Saudi Arabia didn't abolish slavery until the 1960s. At that time, when a king went somewhere, he went with his entourage of slaves. That's what kings of Saudi Arabia did in those days. And so FDR there on one side, King Abdulaziz on that side with his slaves, and they worked out a deal where the U.S. government would protect the royal family in perpetuity, generation to generation. We're now three, well, the king officially is the son of Abdulaziz, but the person running the country, Prince Abdullah, is the grandson of Ibn Saud. And we have a pact to protect the royal family in perpetuity, not Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the property of the king, but to the dynasty. We have an arrangement with the dynasty to protect the dynasty against its enemies in return for access to Saudi Arabian oil, which continues to govern American policy. I'd love to go and tell you the whole story. It's such a fascinating story. But the essence of this is that this created a requirement for the United States. First of all, it created a dependency on Saudi Arabia. Then it produced a requirement for the United States to protect our dependent relationship with Saudi Arabia up until this day, not only to protect the kingdom against its external enemies, but also the dynasty against its internal enemies. And I wish I could say more about all of that. But over the past, so to condense the story, since 1945, the basis, the fulcrum of American policy in the Middle East, especially in the Persian Gulf, is the protection of Saudi Arabian oil. And I want to emphasize that this predated the creation of the State of Israel and the security arrangements subsequently made with Israel. Our relationship with Saudi Arabia is older and much more central to American strategic planning ever since. And so out of this arrangement came the deployment of American forces in the Persian Gulf. It led over time to an ever-increasing deployment of American forces, although we did like to use surrogates when we could. We turned Iran into a surrogate. When the Shah was overthrown in Iraq, when the Shah was overthrown in 1979, 1980, in Iraq invaded Iran, and then this was after the hostage crisis, then the Iranians repelled the Iraqi invasion and started coming around in the direction of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. The U.S. responded by turning Saddam Hussein into a surrogate for the United States. And Donald Rumsfeld, that great champion of human rights and democracy, was sent to embrace Saddam Hussein in December 1983 after it was reported that Iraq was using chemical weapons on, quote, a daily basis, unquote, against Iranian troops. Donald Rumsfeld went to Baghdad, embraced Saddam Hussein, showered him with gifts paid for by the American taxpayer, including satellite data that on Iranian troop positions, which it facilitated the use of chemical weapons by the Iraqi army. So the U.S. is complicit in the Saddam Hussein, or at least the current leadership of the U.S. government, Donald Rumsfeld in particular, and Dick Cheney, who became Secretary of Defense in 1989 and continued to supply this intelligence data to Saddam Hussein, is complicit in the Hussein regime and in the use of weapons of mass destruction. And you notice that in the 1980s, they had no moral compunction about using chemical weapons. This is when they fulminate about the terrible things that Saddam Hussein did with his chemical weapons, killing his own people. At the time, they didn't say anything about this. In the time, they facilitated the use of chemical weapons by Saddam Hussein. That does not deserve applause. That deserves some other kind of rude noises. Yes. That's right. Yes. I'm sorry, I want to make a few more points and try to bring this up to show you how American militarism and oil are intertwined. The next stage in the story is after the U.S. backed Saddam Hussein, he thought, what objection would we have to Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait. I don't know what went through his mind. Certainly nobody was telling him at the time that you're a bad guy and you're going to get in trouble. We continued to provide him with economic assistance well into 1990, doubled economic assistance under the Bush regime, Bush administration senior. So he must have thought he had a free hand. But once he invaded Kuwait, it put his troops on the border with Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi Arabian oil fields are very close to the Kuwait border. This set off alarm bells in Washington. This was a threat to Saudi Arabia. Remember, that's the essence of our policy, is protecting Saudi Arabia. So we sent troops there. President Bush announced on August 8th, 1990, when on national television, many of you will remember, he said, we've drawn a line in the sand. It wasn't just out in the desert somewhere. It was the line on this, between the oil fields and Iraqi troops. And he said, we can't allow the Iraqis to cross that line and take the oil fields and gain control over our economy and destroy our economy. We had to resist with military force. And that was the onset of Operation Desert Storm. To conduct Operation Desert Storm, President Bush sent his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, to meet with King Fahd, the son of Abdulaziz, in his palace in Riyadh on August 6th, 1990. And Cheney pleaded with King Fahd to allow American troops to be based on Saudi territory, which they had resisted because this is the Holy Land, the Islamic Holy Land, tremendous resistance to large numbers of Americans on the soil of Saudi Arabia. King Fahd finally gave in on the making a promise, extracting the promise that they would be withdrawn as soon as Iraq was driven out of Kuwait, and announcing to his people that they would be withdrawn, fighting objections from dissidents in Saudi Arabia, not dissidents, Muslims who objected to this, including Osama bin Laden, who is a friend of the royal family, friend of the United States, but who pleaded with King Fahd not to allow the Americans in. King Fahd said, well, they'll be gone when the war is over, but when the war was over, they weren't all withdrawn. The U.S. kept a large force in Saudi Arabia to conduct the attacks that continue to this day, Operation Southern Watch, the daily attacks. And this is what started in motion the campaign that we know of as Al-Qaeda, which led to the attacks on September 11th. The attacks of September 11th are directly related to this historical relationship that I've described between the United States and the Saudi royal family. That is what 9/11 is about, and the continuing Al-Qaeda struggle is to drive the United States out of Saudi Arabia, and to replace the Saudi royal family with a government that's not corrupted by its ties with the U.S. and U.S. oil companies.
Michael Clare, professor of peace studies at Hampshire College, speaking at the Not In Our Name conference this past weekend. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.